What I want to do today was I want to introduce you to a uniquely Jewish system for bringing out a child's potential. The system is thousands of years old, carried down by tradition. I actually heard it for the first time from an elderly sage in Yerushalayim many years ago and spent years standing by his side trying to absorb the system. And I'm now going to try to give over to you in a systematized way as possible the outline of the system. The thesis behind Jewish parenting is that there are three things that we need to do to raise great kids. Those three things are considered educational, and those three things will bring out their potential. Anything else we do with our kids is at best a waste of time, and it could be it's even counterproductive. Which is very challenging and very exciting because it means I've only got to focus on three things, and if I've got those three things down, my child will become who they could become. And those three elements are something called planting, something called building, and something called prayer. And we'll try to understand how each of those three function. First, planting. Planting is a process which is built into this world. It's part of the physical universe. And we see organic growth everywhere we look, and that process of organic growth stretches from the physical world all the way down into the spiritual world. And therefore, when we're trying to bring forth a child's potential, we rely on the exact same process with the exact same rules as we see in the organic world. How do you plant in the organic world? The way that you do it is, You dig a hole, you drop a seed, and you pour some water in, and then you wait. And you wait. And you wait, because planting takes time. But if properly nurtured, over a period of time, something sprouts. And then if properly nurtured, we'll get spectacular fruit. You can't rush that process. It will happen at its own speed. And every plant is genetically engineered to become itself. And no matter how much I try to force a potato to become an apple, I'm not going to be successful because each has its own identity. That's the nature of planting in the agricultural world. What does planting look like in the spiritual realm when we're dealing with human beings? So it's very similar. You drop a seed in and you water it and you nurture it and you wait. What's the seed? So planting is a cognitive process. That is, what I do is I present to a child over and over and over again perspectives and values. Perspectives are a template that allows the child to look out at physical facts, but instead of seeing just physical facts, they perceive those physical facts through a moral lens so that things take on for them an ethical meaning. Perspective and values are both parts of planting. Values are when I teach a child, this is more important than that. That peace is more important than truth. When I teach children a hierarchy of values, that's half of what planting is all about. And planting is sometimes done explicitly. When I tell my child some lesson, some perspective, I teach them some value explicitly, but often, probably 95% of the time, planting is accomplished by personal example. When I live my life, I am planting in my children. And assuming that I get the seeds into the child, which is a challenge we'll speak about, if I can actually get the seed to the child, and I nurture that child with the unique kind of water that causes children to develop into who they need to be, and we'll talk about what that water is, that seed will take root. It will take root. And therefore, I can relax and wait for the very, very gradual process of that child becoming who they are. There's a fantastic plethora, a depository of wisdom that's been carried by our people for thousands of years called the Mishnah. The Mishnah is divided up into many sections. One of the sections in the Mishnah deals with agricultural law. So, sometimes that section of the Mishnah that deals with agricultural law is referred to as Seder Zeroyim, the section that deals with seeds, agricultural growth. But that same section of the Mishnah has another name. It's sometimes referred to in the Talmud as Seder Emuna. That section of the Talmud that deals with faith. Because when one is involved in planting, you drop those seeds in over and over and over again. You serve as that personal example. You communicate those values and those perspectives. And you don't necessarily see any change immediately in the child. But I believe with perfect faith that if I just continue to serve as that example and to communicate those lessons, those seeds will take root and they will sprout and they will take over the child's entire personality. When I first started studying the system, I had little children. Now I have little grandchildren. And it's so wonderful to be standing on this side of the story and tell you the system works. And when you plant, you can have faith. We have a lot more control over who our children turn out to be than we would like to believe. Whoever we are, that's who they become. And planting is one of the most powerful methods we have for helping our children become who they need to be and who they could become. Okay, what does planting actually look like in real life? Let's take a look at it. I remember years ago, my second son was born. And when he was born, I remember we were at the hospital. My wife took a look at this little newborn and she said to him, "Oh, what a kadosh." And even though we named him formally Hillel Yeshayahu, but it never lasted. He ended up being called Kadosh. Our little holy one. And Kadosh grew up. And I remember we decided we were going to go on a day trip to Netanya. I live in Jerusalem. We were going to go on a day trip to Netanya. And I came home from morning prayers and I walked in and I said, "Okay, Chana, my wife, let's go." And Chana said, "Great. We're just going to do one more thing." And she said, "Take this child, take him to the restroom." And each child, one by one, we took him to the restroom. When the last one went, she said, "Quick, go now!" Expert mother. And we took all of our little children. We packed them onto a bus. We went over to the central bus station in Jerusalem. As soon as we got to the central bus station, being an experienced father with lots of little children, I realized you don't buy, there's two buses that go to Netanya. There's one that stops at every little city on the way. You don't buy that ticket with little children. I bought the express tickets, the one bus, straight shot, Jerusalem, Netanya, and got the tickets. As I was getting the tickets, my wife took each child back to the restroom one more time, was shaking and squeezing, yes. As I got the tickets, they were just coming out of the restroom, and she said, "Okay, we're ready, let's go." And as we run towards the bus, we saw the bus and Tanya was just pulling away, so I waved to him, and as he's pulling away, he waved back. Open the door, as the bus is moving, we're putting our children on one at a time. Finally, we get the last child on. My wife and I pile on, the bus is moving, everyone gets their seats. One child here, one child there, my wife here. I sit down next to the Kadosh. And it's only about, an hour and a half ride. 10 minutes into the ride, Hillel Yeshayahu, a.k.a. Kadosh, turns to me and says, "Abba, I have to use the restroom." I said, "Hillel, that's impossible. Use the restroom twice. Didn't have to go then, have to go now." So I said, "Hillel, don't worry, we're almost there. We'll be there soon." Okay, that was a lie. 15 minutes later, "Abba, have to go now." So I realized that we were not going to make it. There was no way this was going to actually end in a happy story. And so I got up and I walked over to the bus driver. In Israel, everybody has kids. The bus drivers are used to this. I realized I was not going to have a problem. I walked over to the bus driver and I said to him, "Excuse me, but I have a child. We really just pull over one minute on the side and we'll take care of everything. We'll keep going." And the bus driver said, "Express bus doesn't stop." So I tried to explain to him that it was a very serious situation. By this time, people could hear Hill in the back making noises. And it was a very serious situation. And I tried to explain to him, "We really have a problem." But the bus driver was not stopping. By the time we pulled into Netanya, poor Hillel looked a little bit like a pretzel. And he was making noises, and my kids were really worried. The other kids were really worried. And so, you know, the bus stopped, and my kids all jumped up and blocked the aisles. And my wife and I grabbed poor Hillel by the arms and carried him off the bus. And we immediately made a beeline for the restroom. And, you know, we got to the restroom, and there was a big sign that said, "Under construction." And poor Hillel, and he was so disappointed. And I said to him, Hillel, don't worry, there's a boardwalk right here. I'm sure we get out on the boardwalk and we're going to find a place right away. And my kids were so panicked and they were running in front of us. And I saw my kids running down the boardwalk and they went into a shop and out of a shop and into a shop and out of a shop and into a shop and out of a shop. And around the corner, it was not a good sign. We're carrying Hillel down the road. And a minute later, my oldest son comes running around the corner. And he comes and he says, we found a restroom. So I said, where is it? And Hillel, his eyes were just so wide. Where is it? And they said, it's in a bar. And Hillel looks up at me and says, what's a bar? So I said to him, it wasn't me. My oldest son looked at him and said, it's a place where people listen to loud music and get drunk. So Hillel looks up at me and says, I can't go in a bar. At which point I said, why not? So Hillel looks up at me and says, I can't go in a bar because I'm Kadosh. Okay, now I never told my kids not to go in a bar. It never came up. But I never had to, because that little boy had this planting that happened day after day, many times a day, where he was told he was a Kadosh. At some point he learned that word means a holy one. And when he looked in a mirror, he was looking through a set of glasses, and he perceived himself as a little piece of God. He thought it was inappropriate for him to be in a bar. I never taught him such a lesson. But he had a different perspective on himself and on the whole world from a very subtle input that went on for years. Now, of course, you understand that we can plant lots of different things, and we could have called him other names, and that would have gone in as well. So you have to be very, very careful what sort of lessons you plant, because they all take root. And over a period of time, they all take over the child's personality. That's planting up front and live. Let's take a little bit of a look at building. Building is, unlike planting, an inorganic process. When I want to build, what do? So I take a brick and I stick it in place, and I put another brick next to it, another brick on top, and slowly, 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 I construct this wall. Building, unlike planting, is a very quick process. Now, of course, you can stick a brick in, it can slip out if you didn't put it in well, so you have to stick it in again. And you have to make sure you use the proper mortar. Again, we'll talk about what the mortar is, just as we'll speak about later what water is for plants. But once the brick is in, it's in. Building is a very quick process. It's not something that you have to wait years or decades to get results. What does building look like in a human being? So it's inserting bricks, essentially. And what is a brick? So a brick is some concrete behavior or habit. When I teach my child, you should brush your teeth like this, not like this, that's building. When you get up in the morning, wash your hands. That's building. Whenever I dictate a specific behavior to my child, that's called building. And again, the most powerful method that I, as a parent and as a teacher, have for building in my children and in my students is personal example. It's 1,000 times more powerful than anything that I say. And although I've been saying this for many years, only now that my children are much older and they have their children, am I beginning to see that the way that I acted was 1,000 times more powerful than anything that I ever said, for good or for better. And therefore, we have to be very, very careful how we build and what we build. What does building look like in real life? When you look at it in someone's home or in a school, what does it look like? So I'll give you an example. Years ago, I was called in to counsel a couple of parents, wonderful people, really wonderful, amazing parents. And I came to their home and I sat with them, and they told me about their son, Danny, who he had done spectacularly in school until about third grade. And between third grade and fourth grade, things started to fall apart for him. By the time that I had arrived on the scene, this was towards the end of fourth grade, so Danny had basically failed out of school, which is pretty serious for a child that young. And not only did he fail out of school, but he was starting to fail out of life. It was impossible to get the child to engage in any sort of personal hygiene. He wouldn't brush his teeth, wouldn't wash his face. Giving him a bath or a shower was nearly impossible. He was completely unstructured. They had a bus that would take him to school every morning. They said in 2 years, he had never made the bus. And the parents didn't give up on him. Every morning they tried to get him ready and get him out there, and they subscribed to the bus service, but he never made the bus. And the mother always had to drive him to school afterwards because he just couldn't keep the schedule. And of course, it was impossible for him to know by the time he got home what his homework was. There was just absolutely no structure in this child's life. So after speaking to the parents a little bit, I asked if it would be okay if I spent some time with Danny. And they said, sure. So I said, it'd be better if I spent private time. And they said, great. And they came and they introduced me to Danny. And then they retired to the kitchen. And I was sitting in their living room. And I was first just kibitzing with him. And we were schmoozing a little bit and talking. And then we started to play a little bit. And when Danny was relaxed, so I started to ask him about his life. And I said, Danny, how do you get to school? Oh, my mother takes me. Always? Yeah. Is there a bus? Yeah, there's a bus. What time do you have to be ready to catch that bus? And Danny looked at me, and he said, I don't know. So I thought that was an interesting response. So I kept going, and I started asking more questions. I said, Danny, when's your bedtime? I don't know. I said, Danny, when do people brush their teeth? He said, I don't know. And I realized Danny was not the problem. So I played with him a little bit more, and then he went away, he was gonna play ball, and I went in to speak with the parents again. And it was a long shot, but I gave it a try. I looked at the parents and I said to them, tell me something. Isn't it true that one of you had a parent that was a severe disciplinarian and he looked at her and she looked down? And so I focused on her and I said, and when you misbehaved, he was harsh. And she was nodding. And I said, not only was he harsh, but there was a schedule to keep. And if you didn't keep that schedule, then there was hell to pay. And her eyes started to tear up. And I said to her, and you swore, I will never do that to my children. And she looked up at me and she said, and wasn't I right? So she had had such a horrific, nightmarish experience with structure in her life that she associated structure with harshness. And she felt the two were intrinsically linked, and therefore she was going to protect her children from the police state that she had grown up in. And she was going to do that by engaging in planting. And I have to tell you, this couple, I remember until today, they are some of the most expert planters I've ever seen in my life. The way they communicated their values, the personal example they set, and they were consistent, and they really planted beautifully. I mean, really beautifully. But if all you do is plant, and you don't impose a structure, so often the plant will die. It can't make it without a structure. I remember years ago, We were living in an apartment on the third floor in Yerushalayim, and I was speaking to this sage in Jerusalem, Rav Shlomo Volbe, Zichrono Livracha. We were talking to him about the system of planting and building, and he said to me, if you truly want to understand planting, you've got to get yourself a grape plant. And I didn't know what he was talking about, so I went out and I bought a vine, and we put it on our porch. We named him Harold, and we watered him. Okay, Harold sprouted. And he came up maybe, I don't know, a half a meter. And after about a half a meter, he went straight out over the third floor. Now, grapevines are brilliant. And after going out another about a half meter, he realized that there was nothing for him to grab a hold of. So he came back, and when he came back, he grabbed a hold of our trellis. And he sprouted a little tentacle and wrapped around the trellis and then went a little further and wrapped another tentacle around the trellis and a little further and wrapped another tentacle, then dropped the middle one because he didn't need it, right? And kept going till he filled the trellis back and forth with Harold. And 4 years later, I made kiddush on Harold. So what would have happened to Harold had there not been a trellis? Had there not been this fencing around our third floor merpeset, our third floor porch, to prevent children from committing suicide, had that not been there, then what would have happened to Harold? And the answer is grapevines can't survive without structure. If you don't build your children along with planting, so the child can't thrive, if they don't brush their teeth, if they don't take a bath, if they can't get themselves to school, then all of the tremendous potential that's inside of that child will never come out. So what I suggested to them was so obvious and so simple. I said, listen, let's start with a simple star chart. We'll put a chart on the wall, and we'll get these little star stickers. They said, what should we start with? I said, let's start with personal hygiene. Oh, I'm sorry, we started with bedtime. We started with bedtime first. I thought bedtime was more important. We'll go for bedtime first. I remember with Danny, bedtime, the parents didn't believe it could ever happen. And I said to them, we have to have a reward and punishment system. We have to have something to encourage him. And so what we did was we promised him that every day that he got into bed on time, he would get a little star. And when he got a certain number of stars, his parents were going to give him a trip with them. By the way, we believe in rewards. We believe in bribing children and giving them rewards when they behave well. The most valuable rewards, though, are not made of sugar. There's things even sweeter, which is time with mom and dad. And, of course, I'm not opposed to giving a child a piece of chocolate. I'm not opposed to giving a child a toy. But you really want to make a child happy and healthy and stable, give them time with mom and dad. So we had this whole package that he was going to win with a certain number of stars. He was going to get this time with his parents and private time with them. And the punishment would be he had this little jar with money that he collected for doing different things around the house. And every day that he got into bed past his bedtime, he was going to have to pay a fine. So I remember the parents called me after a few days and they said, we don't think it's working. He's paying the fine every night, but we don't think it's working. And then they called me a couple days later and they described this scene. Danny's a very bright child, and he was getting to bed every late, and his parents were putting pressure, you're going to have to pay a fine, you're going to have to pay a fine. And Danny said to them, can't I just give you the money and go to bed late? And his parents said no, and they're great planters, so they kept telling him about the value of sleep and how he's going to feel terrific in the morning and how they have a bedtime, and they showed him their bedtime, and it was great planting. Now the building was in place, and they described to me how one night he only had enough money left for one last fine. And he asked them that morning, please, mom, dad, please, don't let me. It was just the symbolism of losing everything. It was too much. He said, please don't let me lose that last amount of money. Get me into bed on time tonight. And they said, Danny, we're going to try. And that night, they described the scene, how he was dawdling and he was taking time and they couldn't get him into his pajamas. And they said, you know, we want you to make it, we want you to make it. And then finally, there was this panic scene at the end where he threw his pajamas on and he went careening down the hall towards his bedroom. And they said he slid into the door, slammed into the door, dived across the room, hit his bed, looked over at the clock, realized he was about a minute late, and they heard this anguished cry from the back room, I can't afford this! So they arranged credit for him. And they kept going. And these people believe in their children, and they built and they built and they built with a lot of love and a lot of support and no harshness. There was no need for the harshness, just a lot of support and building. And the net result was that Danny got into bed on time. And then they said, where to go to next? And I said, then I said, to personal hygiene, let's brush his teeth so they don't fall out. And, you know, slowly, slowly they built this child. And I met the child maybe 4 years later. And the parents were beaming ear to ear, and they had this beautiful child. And like when I saw him, he was so bedraggled, and he was. And you know, the next time that I saw him 4 years later, you know, the shirt was neat, and he looked terrific. He was dressed to kill, and he had this big smile. The black rings under his eyes were gone. The parents told me he was a straight A student. He was in a terrific environment. He just needed some structure in his life. There's planting, which is giving over the values and the perspectives. There's building, which is providing a healthy structure with firmness but not with harshness, so the child appreciates the support. Even though at the time they may fight it, we're not afraid to be firm and remain firm. And then there's a third element. The third element is prayer. Now, explaining prayer is probably the most difficult because it's so foreign. The Talmudic concept of prayer is so foreign to the way that we relate to prayer today. You know, I often shake myself when I find myself saying, excuse me, I have to go pray. I have to go pray. The Almighty Master of the Universe says, Labe, if you'd like, I can talk to you right now. Anything you want to say to me? The Talmudic perspective on prayer is very interesting. The sage who taught me, Rabbi Volba, he told me that when he was a child, he saw his mother pray for him sometimes 10 times a day. I said, you must have been a bundle of trouble. Now, by the way, it's very significant that Rabbi Volba's mother prayed for him 10 times a day. He didn't say his father because his father was an atheist. His father was very anti-religious. And Rabbi Volba grew up in Berlin a long time before there was any sort of Jewish outreach going on. And his mother was middle of the road. I don't think she would be what we call Orthodox today. But she believed in God and she loved God and she loved Torah. And she wanted her child to have a Jewish identity. And she opened her mouth and she talked to God. 10 times a day she would cry out. And he remembered seeing his mother speaking to God about him. When it comes to educating our kids, you can't wait to step forward into a silent devotion. You got to talk to God with your mouth all day. That's what I do. That's what our forefathers did. We're Jews. We have an open line. He wants to hear from us at any moment. You are his firstborn child. And you can open up your mouth and schmooze with him, talk to him at any moment of the day, and he's dying to hear whatever you have to say, and he loves to take care of us. He loves to take care of us. Sometimes he's just waiting for us to ask. I remember when I first published this system in English, it was in a book called To Kindle a Soul. And I remember the book had just come out. It was due to be released in New York, and there were thousands of copies, almost 20,000 copies sitting in warehouses in New York. And the opening, the release date was coming up in a week. I'll tell you a cute story. I got on the plane to fly to New York to release the book, and I was so excited. Three major networks in America had gotten excited about the book, ABC, NBC, and CBS. They had all offered me opportunities to go on their shows across America. We had booked over 100 radio and television slots before I got on the plane from Israel. And when I got on the plane, I'm flying, I had one copy of the book in my valise, and I sit down on the plane, and this fellow sitting next to me, and I was so excited about the book and the lectures I was about to give that I was flipping through the book and I was going through my notes, and the first hour of the flight, this man is reading over my shoulder the whole way. So after about an hour, I looked up at him, and he looked at me and he said, what's this? So I said, very humbly, it's my new book. So he said, you wrote a book about parenting? I said, yeah. He says, you have any kids? So I said, yeah. I said, I've got five. So at this point, this poor fellow, he turned to the window and he started talking. Now, until today, I don't know if he was talking to me or if he was just talking. He's looking out the window and he says, God, I'd give anything to have five kids. So I looked at him and I said to him, sir, you don't have any children. And he looks back at me and he says, no, I've got eight. So I take the book and I go to New York and I go on the morning show, the CBS morning show in New York. I arrive there and there's a woman who's going to interview me, and a big PR firm was representing us, Reuter Finn, and the representative from Reuter Finn, this major PR firm, said to me before I left Israel, your system has three components, planting, building, and prayer. She says, you're going to America, I recommend that you speak about those first two, they're going to love those. I said, the third is also, she said, no, focus on the first two, that would be very good. So there was obviously a point of conflict here, and I said to her, listen, I can't be dishonest. The system has three parts. I can't misrepresent it. It's the Talmud. I'm just saying over the Talmud in English. I can't misrepresent. She said, Mr. Kelleman, you're a wise man. I'm sure that you will think differently when you get to America. If you mention prayer, we will drop your case. And she was serious. We invested a tremendous amount of money with them. She said, if you mention prayer, we are dumping the entire campaign. So I left, and I remember the trip was planned for it was supposed to be the last week in August, and they put it off. They delayed the release of the book until the second week in September. And I remember there was this accident in the second week of September. This was 2001. There was this accident in New York. And when I got to New York and I was driving out of JFK, there were these massive signs hanging from the bridges that said, "Pray to God." And I went on the morning show. When I got on the morning show, the woman starts asking me questions. Tell us about your system. Well, there's planting. Yeah, could you tell us about the planting? I see there's another component. Could you tell us about building? I explain building. And then she says, I see there's a third component. Do you want to speak about it? And the representative from Reuter Finn was behind the window going. And I said, I would like to speak about it. I would like to speak about it. I looked at the woman, I said, tell me something, you have children? She said, yes. I said, tell me something. Are there situations that you never, ever want your children to experience? And she looked at me for a moment in silence, and then, with her eyes starting to water up, she said, yes, there are situations I never want them to experience. I said, tell me something. Are there people that you never want your children to meet? And with tears flowing down her face, she said, yes, there are people I never want my children to meet. And I said to her, tell me something and be honest. How much control do you have over the situations that your children could fall into or the people that, God forbid, your children could meet? And she looked at me and she said, I have no control. And I said, in this generation, if you don't pray for your children, you are insane. And she said, you are right. And the representative from Reuter Finn said, there's planting, there's building, there's prayer, and there's one last component which makes the whole thing click. And that is, there's the water and the mortar. How do you pass the bricks and seeds into a child? This is the single most important component. They travel through a conduit. That conduit is called relationship. The more that a child feels that my number one priority in the whole world is you, I love you more than I love anybody in the whole world, anything in the whole world. You are first in my world. Nothing in my life comes before you, nothing. The more the child feels that way, the more they will listen to me, absorb from me, take upon me those behaviors, those values, and those perspectives. And to the extent the child feels that there's any other agenda item, to that extent, the conduit narrows, and you start getting a blockage in that artery. And of course, blockages can be deadly. I have, sitting at home, a chart that I've been afraid to publish. It shows the percentage of women in the full-time, percentage of mothers of children in the full-time workforce in the United States of America from 1950 until 1997. I'm sorry, until 2007. And it has its peaks and its troughs, and it follows a very interesting pattern. So I ran a little experiment. I love research. I took a chart that shows the occurrence of ADD and ADHD in America during, it's not exactly the same period because we didn't have measures of ADD and ADHD back as early as 1950. But from when we started keeping statistics, I looked at that chart. They're not the same. They're not the same. There's about a 10-year skew, and then they perfectly match, including every trough and every valley. There are diseases like attention deficit disorder. It's a deficit of attention given to a child. And to the extent that that child feels there are other things in my life that are more important than them, I won't be able to get to them with the bricks, the seeds. I won't be able to produce a psychologically healthy child, certainly not a spiritually healthy child, because spirituality is created by love. And love can't be created in magic moments. Magic moments are sandwiched in these swaths, these massive swaths of time well wasted. It happens when you spend a whole day with your dad fishing, or a wonderful afternoon with your mom at the market. I remember Rabbi Volba told me, pull your kids out of school, pull them out of school, take them out for a day. When I travel, almost without exception, I take one of my children with me. My children are all older now, but they've been doing, for 20 years I've been taking children with me when I travel. I have a 17-year-old, a 19-year-old, a 21-year-old, a 23-year-old, a 25-year-old, and grandchildren. And I take them with me. That's called Jewish education. That's planting and building. That's building that relationship that lets them know that they are the most important thing in the world to me. And that doesn't mean I don't discipline them. If you don't discipline a child, they don't know you love them. So when they need discipline, they get discipline. But it's not harsh. And it's not with the intention that you cause me pain, so I'm going to cause you pain. Or I'll cause you so much pain that like Pavlov's dog, you'll learn not to misbehave. It's measure for measure. You didn't get your shoes on, we missed the party. If you get into bed on time, I can read you the book. But it's not that you didn't get a good grade, so I'm going to throw your bicycle in a trash can. They know that I love them and that I would never cause them pain. Personally, if the pain wasn't intrinsically part of the situation. We possess an incredibly powerful system for educating human beings. We've been doing it for 3,300 years. We have such a heritage. We have transformed mankind. There was no one who could be prouder on this planet than a Jew for our educational accomplishments. And for 3,300 years, we've done it using a traditional system with no admixture from the outside. We can at least turn back to that system today, and we can learn from our heritage how to truly kindle the soul of a child. Thank you.